Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we're piloting a new segment in our regular podcast series. As most of our readers and listeners are aware, Adam and I have worked hard to identify a few independent financial advisory firms that see the world through a similar lens that we do. We did this to have a useful, well-vetted solution to the many requests we get each month from people seeking referral to financial advisors who get it. It wasn't an easy task or one that we took lightly, believe me, but now that we've endorsed these advisors, we thought it would be a very helpful exercise to bring them on the program from time to time to ask them to address the money-related questions our readers care about most. So today, we're doing just that. Over the past week, we asked you to submit your pressing questions about money and investing, and you didn't disappoint. We're going to be speaking with each of our endorsed firms, and today, I'm pleased to be speaking with Bob Fitzwilson, founder and lead partner of the Portola Group, which is the West Coast-based investment management and financial advisory firm we endorse. Bob has been advising clients since the 70s and has a wealth perspective to share. It's really deep. Now, before we get started, I'll make it clear that Peak Prosperity has a commercial relationship with the Portola Group, one in which fees are shared on referred accounts. It's important to note that this arrangement does not result in any increased fees charged to the end customer. You're charged the same as if you'd walked in through the front door. All the details on this arrangement are provided clearly in writing during the referral process. Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, Bob, you ready to get started?
I am.
Excellent. So why don't you tell us about Portola, your experience, and if you could, your investing philosophy?
Well, Portola was started in an interesting period. I personally started in the business in 1973, which frankly was a good time to start because mm-hmm. it was so tumultuous and a great chance to learn in tough times. And Portola Group was started in 1979, which was equally tumultuous. But it's been focused primarily on individuals and families and what's now called wealth management. Philosophically, we believe that on the investment side, that wealth is created by identifying very powerful long-term themes and trying to hang on, and not by trading things like baseball cards. And, you know, it was much less prevalent in the 70s, frankly, through much of my career. But now it just seems like everybody's day trading, and you've got high-frequency trading, and, you know, it's frustrating a lot of people. But, you know, the basics of investing really haven't changed. All the great wealth has been created through some form of equity, although fixed income can be appropriate at various times, and then trying to hang on as long as you can. During the 90s, most of the returns that we achieved were things that just kept getting bigger and bigger that we'd have a discussion about, well, it's think of the taxes, well, oh, if we sell that, things like Microsoft and Cisco. And so it wasn't necessarily a great incremental analysis. It was just a fabulous theme that just kept growing.
Right. So let's cast forward to today. You've obviously been in business for a while now. Has anything in the landscape around risk and how you manage risk, think about risk, has that really changed given, everything that's been in the news lately and certainly with some of the more famous blow-ups that we've had at some of the key institutions out there? There's trust has sort of been hit a little bit and the landscape's changed a little bit. And maybe there's this thing called peak oil. There's a lot of sort of large moving pieces. How's your perception of risk shifted over the years?
Well, it changed dramatically in 2008. You know, I tell people I've learned more in the last 3 years, and a lot of it's through you and your research, than I did in the first 37. You know, what we took for granted, the rule of law, police, courts, all that stuff, honesty from institutions, it may have left a long time ago, but it all became apparent in early 2009. So what we did was we hit the books, and you know I've probably gone back through 2,600 years of history studying all these cycles and trying to figure out what was going on. And what I discovered is that where we are right now is actually quite the norm, not the exception. The last 30 years were historically an aberration, and it's really devolving, unfortunately, to an every man and woman on their own environment. And that includes individuals and companies and governments. And now your work has been, so I've been writing about the massive increase in the printing of money. There was a book called The Great Wave that turned me on to how price waves have hit since the 1300s that are based on a sudden change in the population. But your work on the ceiling, on the resources, has provided the third leg in our thinking. And so it's an extraordinarily risky environment unless you make the mental switch and acknowledge it and then restructure your lives and your portfolios accordingly. And if you do that, I actually think it's one of the best money-making opportunities and the healthiest changes that I've seen in a long time.
Well, let's talk about investing then in this environment. I agree with two main points. One, there are extraordinary opportunities here. And the second is that this is no place for dabblers. I think you either, personally, if I was going to, when I manage my own money, it's a full-time sport for me, or I need somebody else really looking at it. Halfway in between doesn't really work. And that includes handing money off to somebody, some firm, and never sort of tracking and seeing what happens. Mm-hmm. I think this is a time to be a little bit engaged, if not a lot engaged, in one way or another, or to have a lot of faith in who you're working with. So let's get to investing then. We talked about this question before we started recording here. It's an interesting one because it's got a distinction in it. What are the most undesirable / despised assets today is the question. Might they be undervalued as a result? What's your response there?
Well, first of all, as I mentioned, those are mutually, in my business, those are mutually exclusive items. Whenever you, what you look for is a despised asset, whether it's an individual company or a category. Because perceived risk is always highest when things are low, but actual risk is low. And when things are high, perceived risk is very low, but it's actually high. And so it's one of the, as people have said, it's one of the few activities in life when things get really cheap, people want less and less of it. Hmm. So one thing you can do, it comes under a banner of investing called the rubber band theory, that when things get stretched too far one way, they tend to bounce back the other way. And for people who truly want to, quote, outperform, the rubber band concept is one of the few ways that I know of to do it. You wait until things are crushed. For example, in early 2009, and, it wasn't pleasant for anybody investing in that period, but it gives you a chance to pick from all the broken stocks and find the best themes and rebuild your portfolio and get it back. But anyway, going on the theme thing, the studies have shown through my career that 90% of your returns come from your allocation. And the other 10% we divide into two. One is common sense and the other is the genius factor.
Mm-hmm.
And the first part, the common sense, is called theme-based investing. And in any given cycle, I've been through, virtually every kind of cycle you can imagine. But there always are a few dominant themes. You try to identify them, and they're mostly common sense. And so in this cycle, as you pointed out, and others have too, it's energy is a very, very powerful theme. Food's a theme. Water's a theme. Technology's a theme. Precious metals are a theme. Resources in general are a theme. And so there's a whole set of a very, very powerful long-term themes that people can look at. And you don't have, trading is even if there was a genius, because there's so many players and so many computers, trading is a loser's game. You just want to identify the really good themes, the really good companies, and then just try and hang on. I actually think this is the best investment environment in my career, because the large pools of money, most of the money is contained in the hedge funds, in a few of them. And a lot of them are doing this high-frequency trading with computers. So if you look at the most actives on any given day, it's generally the same stocks. And the reason is they have too much money, and they're playing this, my computer's smarter than your computer. But that means that the vast majority of securities are basically open field. Nobody's paying attention. So instead of trying to become a day trader and have a better computer, go old-fashioned. Look at the company. What do they do? What do they make? Why would people want a lot of that? And then just try to hang on.
Well, excellent. So you mentioned at the beginning, allocation, of course, has been a powerful determinant over the, all across at any moment in history, and today is certainly no exception. So if I walked in through your door or called you up and wanted to discuss your approach to portfolio allocation, how would you get me started on that conversation?
Actually, I would start you in a direction you probably didn't imagine. Our roots are in planning. And I was one of the pioneers at putting financial software on microcomputers. I hate to say it, but it was 32 years ago. And my first thing I created was a what-if program on tax planning. But the second thing that was probably the most important was an integrated model of a person or a family's entire financial picture, both now and in the future. And so a portfolio strategy and allocation really should be crafted with it in the short term, paying attention to macroeconomic events and news and all that stuff. But ultimately, the output of that strategy is to fund the lifestyle that you or your family want. So the first thing we would do, and using the software, is to, because it's hard to do it by hand because there's so many variables. Variables would be your life expectancy, your age, when you want to retire. Do you want to give money to charity? Do you want to give money to your children? Do you spend too much money? Do you spend too little money? And what our software does is figure out what that number is that it takes to get you everything you ever wanted. And so the baseline investment target that we've used since we founded the company is 3% after tax and inflation. And we arrived at that because in the late 70s, inflation was, I think, 12 to 14. Taxes in California, the marginal bracket was state and federal, was 73%. So if you were getting 14% in a money market fund, you were probably losing close to 10% in real terms. And so we wanted to figure out what a realistic life expectancy rate of return would be that's after tax and inflation. So at the time, the gross national product in the U.S. was growing about 2.5%. And so we rounded that up to 3 and said that's a good proxy for after tax and inflation returns. 5 is a little more aggressive. So for the holistic, what matters to the person and their family, we start with that 3% after tax and inflation return, take into account all the other things, characteristics of their life, and then try to craft an allocation that gets them where they want to go. It's interesting when I think back now about the 2.5% GDP. I know, Chris, you've done work showing these exponential curves on debt. And it all sort of took off in a big way right before I started my career in Portola Group. And it's interesting that you know, Friedman argued that you should just increase the money supply, I think 3%, which is somewhat equivalent to population growth. And it's interesting that the GDP had been growing at that level until they turned the money printing spigots on, and then things took off. But we still think that 3% after-tax and inflation target for planning purposes is a conservative place to start. And then when it comes to actually investing money, subject to not taking too much risk, you of course want to get as much as you can in the cycle, because sometimes you give it back in another portion of the cycle.
Great. So I have a question here then that reads, what's the most important advice you have to offer investors in each of the 3 key age groups, and where that's the young, the midlife, the elderly. So the young, let's call those people in their 20s and 30s.
I go back to investing in yourself. I mean, you have to, what I try to do, obviously I'm not in my 20s and 30s, but what I try to do on a regular basis is just say, what do I have that I'm counting on, and what would I do if I didn't have it? And unfortunately, in my adult life, we've gotten away from being able to do things. And so for a young person, I would say invest in yourself first and foremost. Try to figure out how to do things. What are the skills that, if you believe that we're coming up on this 20-year cliff and even this fiscal cliff, what are the skills that people would pay me for? And then if you have, and you're going to need, so take care of not just your money, but, the necessities of life. And if you have money left over, maybe some silver coins or something like that. And if you still have money left over, I would probably pick the most powerful theme I can think of, and that's energy. And the beauty of it is a lot of these energy companies are just ridiculously cheap, and technology too. I mean, the irony living in Silicon Valley is that technology used to be the wild and crazy format for investing, but you've got things like Cisco's announcement yesterday of increasing the dividend 75%. Right. I think you're going to see a lot more of that because they just can't deploy that that cash. So they're all almost becoming the dividend plays of the current cycle.
Right. They've become the AT&T of today, in essence. All right. So midlife, 40s and 50s. What's the advice for those that crowd?
Stay employed. The generate as much income as you can possibly generate. Don't even think about retirement. You know, frankly, the most miserable people I know oftentimes are those that retired. But you want to stay active. You want to stay employed. You want to earn as much income as you can. You want to go to a zero-based view of life. It's what do I have? What can I do to provide for myself? And assume that you're going to get no help from things like Social Security and Medicare. And the other thing is get healthy. I tell people, don't argue about who's going to pay for your hip replacement. Mm-hmm. Go out and get healthy so you don't need one.
Mm-hmm. Great advice.
And then get your expense rate down. Because there's the long-term cliff that you and I have talked about, but we're coming up to a moment in history that I personally can't think of anything similar except a couple thousand years ago. And it's going to get resolved. But what we found is that while we all thought we were on parallel paths, what we're coming up to is a common endpoint. And it's going to be problematic. I mean, there just isn't enough money to fund all the things that have been promised. So historically, these promises have either been inflated away or they've just been reneged upon.
Yep.
The retirement assets, there's a lot of questions about can governments do this or that? And I think my answer is that governments will, they're also in the category of every man or woman for themselves. And so they can and do whatever they feel they need to do. So, putting money into a retirement plan, in the early 80s, they said we didn't have enough savings, so they created these plans. And we had the Social Security Commission, the Blue Ribbon Committee, all these great people, and we ignored pretty much every one of their recommendations. But we went from, say, a 73% marginal bracket in California down to low 30s. And so you were saving money at a high rate, tax rate, and having it grow tax-deferred, and then ideally taking it out at that lower rate. And we have the opposite situation now. I mean, it's almost anathema to say don't put money into these retirement accounts, but you're basically putting money, you're saving taxes at a low rate, putting it into what will inevitably become a higher rate, and you run the risk that something untoward happens from a government to your money.
Well, I want to dive a little bit more deeply into retirement accounts in just a second. The third category. So for people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, what's the advice you have there?
I would say if you're in your 60s and maybe even your 70s, the advice is the same for if in your 40s. If you have a skill, you can get paid for it. Keep doing that. Cut back to the bone on spending. And if you're in your 80s, the time frames for resolution on this stuff are probably pretty short, so I'm not even sure that if you're in your 80s, it's a whole lot different. But the other thing is whether you're young or old, plan your portfolio for a human life expectancy. So I tend to find, I think people are trying to figure all this stuff out, and it's impossible to figure it out. I think we know how we got here and who's doing what to whom, but it's really a chaotic system, and the end of it has been seen many times in history, but the timing of it and the specifics are unknown. So, it's interesting to handicap what's going on, but always keep coming back to you and your family and say, what do I need? If I need $500,000 or $300,000 to meet my goals. Do I really want to be a day trader and bet on what the Bundesbank is going to do to get double or triple that? and run the risk of losing what I've got.
Interesting. So let's, while we're there, you mentioned Bundesbank. Any special considerations that you would augment any of this advice for our international listeners?
Most of, I think what I said is true. I mean, mm-hmm. There's been some specifics about taxes in the U.S., but this is a very often seen and scary moment in history. Like I said, I've gone back 2,600 years, and it's as regular as you can be. I mean, every culture, every country, every time frame, they've all done this, and in the end, you have a collapse of paper money, and things go back into real assets. I also think that, and your work, I think, supports this, that we're seeing the end of this 200-year virtuous cycle, mm-hmm. And things are going to head back in that direction. And I don't know how far they head back in that direction is a function, whether it's some sort of a catastrophic conclusion or adults take over again and we work hard and compromise and work our way out of this stuff. But it's not wise to avoid preparing for the possibility of the catastrophic outcome, and that means sustainability, personal preparation, have some gold and silver, solar, learn how to grow food, plant fruit trees, all those sorts of things, and that's common to everybody on the planet.
Yeah, obviously local mileage might vary. Brazil might have a better run at it than maybe Japan, for instance, but this is a global phenomenon. That's one kind of thing that's a little bit different this time, is there's really no borders. You can just easily duck across. So if in 22 you didn't like 1922, you didn't like what Germany was doing with their printing press, there were four borders to go, duck across.
Right.
Much more difficult to duck these days, and certainly with what's going on in Europe, that's becoming really apparent over there too.
Before we, just one quick comment on what you said. The one thing we can't duck is what you've highlighted. You know, all this other stuff is human stuff about who's going to pay for what and when do I retire and what's my money worth and all that stuff. But you can't duck the energy problem.
Right.
And so we are going to have to come together in the next 20 years, and prices are going to have to rise. That's just, it's out of our control.
Right.
Given the technology we've got now. Maybe that'll change, but given what we know, it's like the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about.
Right. Our perceptions do get shaped by recent experience. And I believe it was 1998 that the percent of disposable income in the U.S. that was applied to food and fuel hit an all-time ever historic low at about 14%. And it's been climbing up a little bit since then. But the long-term historical average in other places in the world will confirm this is around 50%. And so if
Wow.
we just think about how we get back to that, do we do it in fits and starts, gradually, slowly, or kind of all at once in some event in the Middle East? It does, one way or the other, it happens probably. So if you believe in that rubber band going back to its normal place, that's everything you've advised so far, all things that I fully believe in, that if we can become more resilient to food and energy at this stage in our life through gardening efforts, through investments we can make in our house, so that we can spend less cash in the future on those things, those are obviously great steps towards resilience and higher quality of life, maybe a healthier life. All that's possible. So I love having this conversation. So retirement accounts. Here's the question. How safe are retirement accounts really? You mentioned that there's a risk here potentially that we don't know what the government's going to do in the future. Maybe there'll be increased taxes at withdrawal at some point, or forced investment in government securities during a national emergency. Maybe there's even the confiscation of them, as we saw that one time. A very small tax in Ireland, I believe, they proposed and passed a one-time 0.8% tax on pension assets at that point in time. Are these things that are on your radar screen, and how would you respond to the question, how safe are retirement account assets?
Everything is possible, and everything you've outlined has occurred. I think Argentina has done this twice in the last 10 or 12 years. I think one healthy way to look at it, though, and I'm probably not going to get many fans for this, but remember that the retirement account is think of Uncle Sam as your silent partner. And so the deal was that you could defer your taxes and compound tax deferred. But in the end, when you took it out, Uncle Sam wants their cut back. And so, you can you can easily imagine, governments need money. And so they're looking at that multi-trillion dollar pool of assets and saying, you know, I want to cash out my one-third or whatever it is that they're due. So so there's that risk. And the biggest risk, certainly one of the biggest risks, is the rise in rates. You know, yeah, you're going to compound tax deferred, and let's say you're a genius at investing, but if rates double, then you pretty much gave up everything you made. Mm-hmm. So I think people really have to take a hard look at whether they put money in there. It's probably better to pay the lower tax and buy the sustainability things we talked about, or the investment things we talked about. And then sometime between now and the year end, in the U.S. in particular, they have to make a really ugly decision about whether to keep money in there at all.
Right. Right. Well, let's talk about that, because that comes up a lot. People who are wondering, you know, they have a significant portion of their identifiable net worth is in a 401k or an IRA. And let's say it's 50% or more of their total asset base. And there are things which they would like to deploy that money towards, but they look at the money that's in that 401k or IRA and they think, wow, if I pull that out after all is said and done, I might be taking a 50% hit on that right now. How would you help somebody walk through that calculation?
Well, the first thing I'd do, going back to my computer software and tax planning days, is that, you know, the tax code, it wasn't architected. It's a hairball of things that were glued together. And so, there's no such thing as a person's tax bracket. It depends on the kind of income you're testing and the amount. So for those familiar with Disneyland, you might be in Frontierland with $10 change, and you could be in Tomorrowland, before you know it, at a completely different tax bracket. Or it could be $1 million. You just can't do it in your head. And oftentimes, so people might say, well, I'm going to lose half this to taxes, but they haven't run a tax projection yet to see where they really are.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I would do is have their tax professional run a base case. Well, here's where I am, and here's what happens if I took money out. And oftentimes you can take money out that only hits the lower brackets. So it's critical, before anybody did something, to have somebody they trust run a tax projection and see what the actual tax hit would be. And then after that, it's like I said, it's an ugly decision, and perhaps you can mitigate it by taking some out now and some out later. But you know, I see no way that taxes are not going to go up. And it does, you know. I believe it was in the late 80s, after they told us to save all this money, they told us that we saved too much, and then they came out with an excise tax.
Uh-huh.
I think it was 10% or 15%.
Yep.
So just assume, my assumption is that anything is possible, but make it personal. Don't use rule of thumbs.
Right.
You know, run a tax projection, see how it could be, going back to the holistic view of a family's finances. Take a look at the big picture. If you had a huge IRA and you wound up losing 40% to taxes, but that 60% left over made you twice financially independent, then who cares? It's safer to lock in your financial independence than to run the risk that something bad happens to the money.
Right. It's I'm thinking of Greece, Japan. Who else has raised taxes recently? Certainly, I mean, there's all sorts of levies and fees and interesting little incremental things that happen. But when governments get strapped for cash, they raise taxes. That's historically, you can take that one to the bank. That's pretty much a guarantee.
There was just something, I think 2 days ago, where Spanish depositors were told that they could get their money back, but only a portion. But then they would pay them back the rest of it over time.
Oh.
That's a story.
Enforced borrowing by the government.
Yes.
That's interesting.
I actually hope that what they... I mean, this isn't... I'm just reacting to where we are, not to what I would have hoped. But, you know, your work showed that they have to get the nominal GDP back up to the debt growth and the obligation growth.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great questions I've had is that that's the obvious solution here. It's going to create a lot of inflation down the road, but... you have these, it's like somebody losing their job on their mortgage. You've got this fixed debt, and the income went away. So you have to get the income back up, even if it's in inflated dollars. Otherwise, you have a structural problem.
Well, yes, and those structural problems have been accumulating for a while. Different conversation, which I'd love to get to, but it does point to the idea that we will be seeing more of the same. You know, we'll see when the next QE comes. I'd like to turn to precious metals now. And first, let's start with your position on precious metals and whether you agree that these are a useful part in portfolio allocation.
Yes. It's always been in our DNA. Remember, we started in 79, so mm-hmm. I think our allocation in 79 and 80 was around 15%. Mm-hmm. But in those days, you had alternative currencies, you know, analogous right. to your border analogy with Germany. We had the Swiss franc, and we had the Deutschmark, and we had the yen. So you could, we call the category the dollar hedge. So you could hedge your risk by going to those. But we also had real estate. Real estate was a terrific asset class in that period. So we had a large allocation there. We had a large allocation to Asia at that time. None of those, or most of those circumstances aren't true anymore. It's all currencies that are getting in trouble. And so the allocation to precious metals is significantly higher than it was in those days, just because that's pretty much the only game in town in terms of alternative forms of money. And as you probably know, we view the bullion as money, as humans have done throughout history. I joke that when the first guy in North Africa fled, he didn't load up his plane with derivatives, he loaded it up with gold.
Uh-huh.
So in terms of preserving wealth, history tells us that gold and silver are the primary formats. So yes, we have a strong belief, and you have to. I mean, you know, gold. I've used an analogy of bar stools and currencies, and an ounce of gold on all in the same bar stool on stable ground. And what's happening is the currency bar stools are sinking. And so if you're standing on one of those looking up, you're saying, my goodness, look how high gold is going. And the truth is that it's the currencies that are sinking. So I've referred to it, we're going to hit a stage where we have a hyper deflation of the currencies. And it'll happen quickly. For money that's allocated for wealth preservation, there's nothing better than holding the metals. The miners, we have an allocation to the miners, and you know these are businesses. And my recollection is that the miners didn't take off until the late part of the cycle in the 70s. The problem in this cycle is the price of gold is up, and silver, but the operating costs have gone up. I read that one company's gone from using 14 gallons of diesel per ounce of gold to 40 ounces of diesel in the last 10 years. We have an allocation there, but those are more long-term oriented. You're going to need to have the price of these metals really break through and have the expenses stabilize before you can expect to get what you're hoping for there.
Yeah, there's been a few other things on the miners, not the least of which was there was some share dilution going on in some of the bigger players for a while. And at
right.
any rate, the cash flow from operations has not been knocking me off my bar stool,
right.
and I'm waiting. But I think, if gold really takes the next run here as it breaks out of this pennant and heads off it, obviously miners would have a role to play there. Here's a question, though. How do you know when it's time to sell gold? Maybe there are people thinking gold has already had its run. Your thoughts there, and how will you know it's time to sell?
May I add just one comment to what we just discussed?
Sure. Yeah, go for it.
So throughout my career, there's been a phrase called laddering, where people would, when they wanted to get conservative, they would ladder fixed income, whether the treasuries, munis, corporates. And laddering means you divvy the money up over different maturity dates. And in this cycle, what I tell people, they should have a laddered wealth preservation portfolio, and not in fixed income because rates are at historic lows, and they're actually toxic and dangerous. But laddering wealth preservation portfolio is going to include metals, miners, particularly energy, food related. Technology, things like that, getting into real assets, but not in a bunker mode, just getting to things that are most likely to benefit from the next cycle. as far as when to sell gold, I've always said when they stop printing. I mean, gold is going up only because they keep driving the currencies into the dirt. And I would welcome that day. You know, I don't want to, frankly, own gold. But as these obligations keep going up and budget deficits keep going up, and, you know, I think they really do have this singular choice. They either print or we go into a massive deflation. And, you know, frankly, in the last week and particularly in the last couple of days, it looks like they're going to print. Brazil just announced a huge stimulus package. I heard this morning that China is making hints that they're going to do it. And frankly, they have to. And even though it's not good economics at this point, I wish they'd just get on with it and start printing.
I'm kind of waiting for them to get on with it too, and I think Japan's going to have to print as well. And we look at their current account deficit perilously close to zero as their trade surplus morphed into a deficit, and U.S. is clearly making noises about printing, and Europe's got to do it as well. So yeah, let's get on with it. Here's a question: how are precious metals taxed, and are there legal strategies for minimizing these taxes?
In the U.S., I think they're taxed at a maximum of 28%. They're considered collectibles. But again, you have to really look at the specifics about a person's situation and not just use rules of thumb. I heard a year or two ago that silver was subject to the VAT tax. I didn't do much work research beyond that. So there are going to be differences. But, this is not... minimization. Most of the mistakes I've seen made in my career are people trying to minimize their taxes, and they wound up minimizing their assets.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you want to try and optimize around these things, but the main thing is to get the allocations right and to protect your money.
All right. Next question: are retirement accounts suitable vehicles for investing in precious metals? This sort of combines this topic and the last one.
Well, I think if we forget the tax issue and confiscation issue and all that stuff. The other issue that is who really has the metal? Does it exist? And so if you're going to have metal custodied by somebody else, you have to make excruciatingly clear, do they have it? Is it allocated to you? And where is it? Because there are indications that there may be games being played. And certainly MF Global was a good example of that. So if you're going to keep it in an account, or frankly even with a brokerage account, you have to be crystal clear as to does it exist and who owns it and how do you get access to it.
Right. So let's talk about the risk that might exist with gold. It's actually both one of the most intriguing characteristics about it, but it's also a risk. And here's the intriguing characteristic. What do you think the chances are of gold getting remonetized? And that's sort of the opportunity, because if it does, we could all make up numbers for what the remonetization level might be. And then the risk embedded in that for some is the idea that if it ever got to be remonetized, it would be declared a substance of national emergency or interest and potentially confiscated. Where do you stand on the ideas of remonetization and or some sort of nationalization at some point?
Well, I think it will be remonetized because that's the way it's always played out through history. The cycle is always the same, that it starts out with some form of metals, oftentimes gold and silver, but it's been copper and iron. And then some form of derivative gets created, and then they abuse the derivative, and a massive amount of it grows, and then it collapses, and then it goes back to the real assets. And so it's no accident that central banks are gobbling up as much gold as they can, because if there is a change in the currency status at some point, to play this game, you have to have something that people believe in to be able to go back to printing currency again. And for me, what matters is the stable relationship. Some people say there isn't enough gold to do it, and I say, I don't care if it's an atom of gold, but currency is an intermediary between a transaction. And so so all I care about is that it's tied to something that isn't going to change and won't be abused. So, you know, it's been our history. You know, I as a kid, until I was almost out of my teens, I used silver as money.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that it's you're wacky and crazy if you believe in monetizing gold and silver is bizarre to me, because that was how I started out my life.
That was part of your actual life. You know, one of the most interesting relationships that I look at is oil priced in grams of gold, and it's one of the flat. It's suspiciously flat. It's amazing, you know, that through all of the gyrations, I think of both of those as fairly high beta commodities. You know, they've got a lot of wiggle in their daily and monthly price charts, and yet, despite all of that, when you look at one compared to the other, there's an incredibly stable relationship there, which speaks to me of the idea that it was the bar stools that were going down and up and down. You know, it wasn't gold and oil have had a very constant sort of utility in our landscape, and so that their relationship to each other hasn't changed. What has changed is the relationship of money to those two commodities, and I'm expecting a lot more of that shifting going on. But gold and oil might maintain that stable relationship, which to me means if I'm holding my wealth in gold, no matter what happens to the price of oil, I'm hedged, as it were, you know, exclusive of these other considerations of higher taxation or nationalization or other things that might happen.
But the, you know, one of the changes in my thinking in the recent years is that you don't want to have a sole focus on gold and silver, because all kinds of bad things could happen, you know, confiscation, taxes, whatever, robbery, all that stuff. And the really healthy thing to do is what you pioneered, is just view it as a part of your life going forward. And so if you develop a skill, that can't be taken from you. If you grow vegetables that you consume, you know, that probably can't be taken care of. So you just have to view it in terms of your life, not become totally sucked in and obsessed by how much gold can I get, how much silver can I get, because, you know, this is about moving forward with our lives and our families.
Oh, I agree. Gold has always been a transition element to me. And as we transition from this fascination with fiat paper back to something else, things.
Mm-hmm.
The transition's taking longer than I thought, but
well, we thought bicycles were going to be a big deal in 1980, and they were 10 years later.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, these things are humbling when you try to figure out. And again, that's why I try to emphasize to people is that it's fun to intellectualize about this and study it, but it's a dynamic, chaotic system where every man or woman's for themselves, and so it could take longer than people expect and manifest itself in many ways before the end conclusion.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're almost out of time here. I want to close with what I think is an extremely important question here, and I'm hoping you can answer this, because this one's on the tip of a lot of tongues these days, and the question is this. With markets so manipulated by the big interests and infected by the HFT, that's the high-frequency trading algorithms, how can a financial advisor recommend being in them being the markets?
Well, I think what I touched on earlier, this is actually kid in a candy store time.
Mm-hmm.
If you're avoiding what the computers and the high-frequency traders are playing. If you let's say that you want to buy a stock that the computers are playing with, and we've all seen these graphs, you know, it's like a muddy pond. It seems calm on the surface, but there's all kinds of cavorting beasties going on underneath the surface. You can't control that. And so what you can control, though, is to try and find investments and companies, businesses and products that people are going to want going forward, and they will. And so if somebody nicks you on your stop loss in the short term or on the spread, you know, there's not much you can do about that in the short term. And where you're going to really make your money is not the pennies you lost in the spread. It's the tens of dollars, hundreds of dollars you're going to make if you get the story right.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the vast majority of securities, these institutions cannot even play there because they're just not big enough or the volume isn't big enough. So look for something It's a great business, domestic, international, great products, great outlook, and then, frankly, take advantage of the HFTs. If they drive something down, then just step right up and load up your portfolio.
That's great advice. I assume you have things that you're looking at that you like, that you are interested in. We won't get into those right now. But the lesson, I like this idea of the judo move on the HFT algorithms, because what they're doing is they're playing with price exclusive of almost any other piece of information, which means they're going to get the price wrong, both up and down quite often. But they don't care about that, because what they care about is battling each other over the minute shifts in price. It doesn't matter if it's over or undervalued dramatically. So you're saying sometimes that behavior of theirs creates opportunities.
My solution would be to create another Las Vegas where all these people go, and the best minds in the business with the best computers, and let them go at it, but just disconnect it from the actual capital markets.
That would be certainly fun. Well, Bob, thank you so much. We didn't get to all the questions. I want to point that out here, and we will get to them if you're willing in a subsequent podcast. But thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
Excellent. And I want to, if anybody is interested in working with any of our endorsed financial advisors, I would invite you to go to the homepage of peakprosperity.com, scroll to the bottom, and down there under resources, you will see endorsed advisors. And just click on that, and we have a process, and we'll be able to work with you and get you pointed in the right direction if that's of interest to you. So again, Bob, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Anytime. Thank you, Chris.